Now let's return to Tom Sheehan for a poem called Once Upon a Timely Moment. This was his second piece in the issue.
Once upon a timely moment. Apprehensive, she pushed open the door to take a final look, to check the earth as far as she could see, to measure, to see if the gods she held were less than perfect. This was her world. The terror she found was in the measurement, in the time she had spent exploring dividend possibilities, the market's surge, a late movie thought more boisterous than life itself, someone's divorce, chicanery and outright theft, and a rigged election all too soon winked at. It came at her, the swift thought, our feet are caught in place. We are sucked into loam and hardpan and left for all of this rock. We are locked up tighter than the grip of stable Earth's 17-degree axis. Escape is not here, our atonement for us. She kept saying we, kept herself aligned in that rare and human confederacy. There was assessment and agreement not known about. At that moment, in one half held the breath, hoe in hand, eyes gone to marble, a gaunt Filipino suddenly apprehends a minor shift in the earth's crust. It is the odd way she would know a tilt at a pinball machine. Beyond him, her, momentous Krakatoa, an island yet, proves to be imaginative again at the foot of history and is no longer breathless. And deeper yet, farther away, thought to be buried out there in the fluffed accountabilities of time, one long, horse-tailed, red-eyed, incommutable comet picks up a little bit of left-hand English just for the hell of it.
The next poem we'll hear is from Marjorie Stamm Rosenfeld, who's done poetry therapy with forensic patients at St. Elizabeth's Hospital and maintains three websites on parish Jewish communities in Eastern Europe.
Response to an invitation. The city is celebrating its 420th birthday with speeches, dancing, good Lithuanian food, and Alus beer. The vice mayor has asked that all former residents be invited home on this special day. Consider the spaces between trees. This is how you get to the forest, where you dug down until the ground got warm, fashioned a door out of branches, leaves for disguise. You have to start while the dirt's still soft. Make no sound, only the thug-thug of the stolen shovel, its iron haft biting the heel of your hand. Lie down in dirt, eat the brown slop of your mother, Lithuanian soil. If you go deep, you can survive the winter to emerge later, moonstruck, under a shower of night-blooming stars. Meanwhile, there were the lakes. Litvox, even displaced, paint these lakes, longing for homeland. Blue lakes, serene, still. All that gleaming water, looking for the world as if there were nothing to be dredged up, in spite of these lifetimes of fear, words, my flat ocean of tears. You ask, how long till I cease this weeping? I tell you, never is not long enough.
Now let's listen to another poem from Christina Pacos. This is called Such Imperfection.
Such imperfection. Belief is the wound that knowledge heals. Ursula K. Le Guin, The Telling. A year since falling on my knees to the earth, deer calling across the dark meadow, brittle queen, Anne's lace and late comer daisy, all the dying grasses. Orion hunts above the ridge where snatches of conversation from luxury homes wafts down like dew, which is also falling exactly like the old hymns say, balm of heaven on earth. The mosquito whine of traffic in all seasons, louder now the leaves have begun their journey to soil. Drivers on Antioch and Barry stare at billboards announcing human dwellings for sale from the 250s. Fetal now, body and soul posing a question worthy of a sibyl. Where, then, do we live? Down by the creek, deer, impatient but wary, cough. From a hollow in the meadow above us, an answer. I must rise and try to walk another way.
For nearly 15 years, Jeffrey Skemp has been performing his short tales and poems accompanied by various talented musicians and highly recommends it. On the following poem, Jeffrey is accompanied by John Coburn on the banjo while he himself plunks away in the toy piano.
Last night, I dreamt oceans of straw covered the world. Men brewing with their noses and sifting with their teeth in hopes of finding the last matchstick. To taste, we need to breathe. We need skin. There are weathermen in the basement of basements playing truth or dare. Above them, the straw forever dry and delicate as their teeth glow with thirst. They have swollen faces and they won't give up. They won't stop pointing at the ceiling and saying, the chance of rain is better than ever.
Next up is a poem by Kate Bernadette Benedict. Kate is the author of the full-length poetry collection Hear From Away, and she's also the editor of the online magazine Umbrella. Here she is reading High Water.
West of here, an incursion, a storm surge, the breakwaters give way. East of here, levees burst in an unseasonable torrent. The tarns of the Tetons decant their ice melt into this basin of ours, this gold chalice of once habitable land. Convergence, deluge. Ilui, Ilui, the heartland has gone missing. And the tribe of the Gros Ventre. I am water brought. I float up to the cathedral ceiling, toward a last lungful of air. Where is the animal who feels no fear? Going under, I hear buffalo bellowing, owls hooing at noon.
Like the last two poets, Julia Martin is a first-time contributor to Carts Looney with this issue. She describes herself as a lapsed lawyer who now battles the apocalypse by bringing new books and pleasure reading to low-income children in the Chicago area, where she serves as the executive director of Bread for the Head.
Extinction. You were the only member. Not quite domain. a hungry sect, my species. Now, a lone attenuated form, vestigial remnant like Garin flooded quarry pit, or possum, wire hanger tail, an anxious crunch of kit's dry meal from set out pail. How must I mourn? My problems are too many teeth. They seem unduly dull. Or vegetation's plot, perhaps. A shift in serration, evading failure's dentation. The way the world mutates beyond peripheries of sight. Do I adapt? If so, what tune should I now whistle? At crepuscule, noon, through what constructed beak, and, Lord, to whom?
Now here's another poem by Thomas P. Levy. Once again, he's accompanied here by an original piece of music composed by his friends in Failboat.
A preemptive elegy for Madeline Levy. When the anchors go away, they will forget their farmers. They will lean, woven with soil, into damp patches of morning, quilting a settlement of gift-swollen seeds. When you go away, I hope I will inherit your rake which dreams of asparagus. You might by then be an overflowing, a soup stain on a tablecloth. You might be burrowed lettuce-like into the fields of so many nights. You might be sulfur-broken wings wrinkled against the horizon while I navigate a bitter maze of patient hands, raking a patchwork of dirt.
Our next featured poet here is Alice George. This is one of two poems by her in this issue. Her first collection of poetry, This Must Be the Place, has just been published by Mayapple Press. Here she is reading The Creature.
The Creature. Friday morning, rush hour traffic, and suddenly from within the tight curl of the I-94 cloverleaf, there arose something first manifest through scent. Like blood and apricots, and color, olive green with russet edges. Of course, who is more beautiful and loathsome than us? Stupid in ways, we don't allow ourselves to be stupid. Brilliant in ways, escape us. But I only learned this later, after the scooping up and dumping onto after the lair visit, and deep conversation after my betrayal, after the show. At that moment, all I knew was relief that something so big had happened without anyone stopping it. When people ask me what I remember most, I tell them about the nature of its skin, moist and healthy, covered with scales that seemed to imply imperviousness, yet failed in the end, as we all know. And I mention the tenderness because that's part of the last promise I made myself, even as I pointed the chopper towards its home. I'm not speaking of the creature's tenderness, for that is well documented. I mean my own, the way my time with him softened the concrete house of my heart.
Our next contributor to the issue, E. Moya, describes herself simply as a working writer trying to survive Los Angeles.
The deepest part. Diving into the deepest part, and even looking at it on a map, its dark blue stillness commands a respect, like a Dietrich or a Marlowe. It lures you by its perhaps danger. You take a swallow, loud like thunder, a universe not littered by stars, smooth, clean. It's a mythistine reach's call, soundless echoes, vibrations no lungs can make. This must be the distant song of sirens shielded by its opaque depth, tristful moans that lure me out of bed some nights, wails on a beach, so appear tramontane and epic, no longer royal, but deflated blue-gray sacks on colorless sand that our hands fast push back towards the deeper part, those ultramarine pools, they prepare a feint.
The next poem in the issue is another one of a pair of poems from a brand new contributor, Sarah J. Sloat, who's been published all over the place, online and in print, but For her bio for this issue, all she wanted us to say is that she grew up in New Jersey and is currently living in Germany.
Approaching the nuclear facility. Vase is thrown with grayish clay, sculpted to stack like bracelets, laid to cinch near the middle. Livestock graze the grass, clover sprouts unbothered. From the hilltop, the bracelets form the elongated neck of a Nidabele, foreign, disembodied in the pasture's lap, facing who knows which direction.
Lisa Jones is up next. She writes poetry in Stockton, California, and is a staff writer for Sacramento's Poetry Now.
Of asphalt. Black rubber, black road, white stripe, grit of gravel. Music interrupting the assault of wind on a half-rolled window. In the distance suspended above it, the world melts. The bounce, bounce, bounce of balls calling each day, echoing into its flat resistance. Offering its peculiar tarry incense to the child lying on her back, killing time. In the still headlamp-lit night, the dark ocean around a big box store, the loneliness of the freeway blowing by. Knowing burnt rubber and the knees of children, knowing sky. The quiet of a hotel pool in winter, the space inside the mouth wrapping up the earth.
Now, one thing we can't bring you with these podcasts, of course, are the many great images in the issue, but what we can do now is give you the audio track for the one video we published this issue. It's called Time Capsule Chronicles, and it's by yet another first-time contributor to the magazine, Christine Swint. Christine Swint writes poetry, fiction, and personal essays, and is the co-editor of a new literary magazine, Ouroboros, and she hails from the metro Atlanta area.
Time Capsule Chronicles. Our plastic skin melts when we turn our faces to the sun. We have grown chrome exoskeletons to crawl along highways. Clumps of us search for home, frantic. All the exit ramps are closed. Helicopter scouts, like distant metal dragonflies, cut a path through fumes. We follow, lost. Webs of estrogen cells, sticky fluids, trap whole families. We play with petroleum toys, believe in the absolute value of garbage. We have sex on top of asphalt, entwined in back seats, jeans bunched around our ankles, skin glowing green from dashboard dials. The past is champagne and Swiss chard, the present greasy cardboard meals. We eat our days in reverse, cut our legs off at the stems, drive around in circles until we run out of gas.
Holly Waymire, our next author in the roster, works as a tax marketing writer for an accounting firm in Chicago. Someday, she said she hopes to be the poet laureate for a small tropical island where she will be paid in mangoes.
Invisible. Delivery trucks line financial, that half street stunted by train tracks and Board of Trade barriers. Vehicle signage announces document destruction, Evian, Ajax Security, Minute Maid. I walk swiftly from condo to office as pigeons scatter slowly at my feet, completely assimilated, scavenging leftover goldfish and sun chips. Men push dollies laden with soda to the back doors of sandwich shops, up loading dock ramps, bound for vending machines and refrigerated cases, where they will sit next to bottled water and cups of sliced fruit. The CEO decides to refocus the firm on first principles, which results in the obsolescence of an entire division, which empties a floor or two of a Louis Sullivan building, which means fewer workers buying coffee and bagels and yogurt, which bankrupts the old man in the lobby, which means one less delivery truck on financial, which means Carlos must take a second shift to make up the lost wages, which is why he stumbles from lack of sleep and spills soda cans on the sidewalk before me. I walk around the cans. My boots crunch on the salty streets. My face aches. Fingers are numb. Nose runs. A train curves shakily round its elevated corner, delivering the next wave of office workers to the newsstand, the nail salon, the flower shop.
Now, we've been playing some tracks with some pretty fancy audio accompaniment in the background, but this next selection was an audio track from its inception. This is a piece of music, original music, by Paul Millington and Norman Ball. And Norman Ball is a Virginia-based writer, musician, and videographer. And Paul Millington is a musician currently living in Australia. So let's give a listen to their song called It's True.
Drank your angel under the table. He bet his wings on a room with a view or two. You're hearing something, let's Bible thumping. You ate the worm, now your sanity's screwed. It's true. Get some religion, better position. Scream at the sky, cause Hail Mary's won't do for you. Sanity's screwed. The stars say we're alone. Yeah, the stars say we're alone. Someone stole the phone, set fire to the throne, lighted skies have flown, lighted skies have flown. Nothing can fix ya, there's no elixir. Your nightmare staked out the empty back room. It's true, the bombing call for love at a dollar. God rents a stool at the border saloon. It's true. So true, would I ever lie to you? You're down with something, it's Bible thumping. The truth's coming through, it's true. It's all the gospel tune. Have I ever lied to you? Now tell me true. Lord, take care of you.
And do
Jesus is fed up with being held up. He called in sick, said he's nursing a wound. It's true. His new attorney retraced the journey. Someone got framed him. They're planning to sue. It's true. The stars say we're alone. Yeah, the stars say we're alone. Someone stole the phone, set fire to the throne. Lighted skies have flown. Lighted skies have flown.
Wow, well, we're going to try to wind down from that with another poem by Howie Good. This one is called Alligator Heart, Part 2. And no, you didn't miss a part one earlier in the issue.
Alligator Heart, Part 2. Sure, you've reasons to weep. Who hasn't? But please, you still have me, with shelf upon disorganized shelf of inventory. So what if the sun sticks its thumb in your eye and the ATM refuses you? So what if the guests leave for the wedding and never arrive? From somewhere, there's loud and incoherent hammering, rockets with bright tails tilting toward the void. Another solar system built just for you, out of love and cannibalized parts.
Our next poem is simply called England by Paul Stevens, another first-time contributor who was in fact born in England but now lives in Australia, where he edits the Kimmera and Shit Creek Review.
England. Shrubs in the hedgerow sharps whisper conspiracies with breath of grey wind, torn from shrouds stretched over the land of fear. Sheep stand cold in the rain. Tree branches fracture light fault lines, fingering upwards where the ravens clot, circle, clot. Locked down land, squeezed tight. Police country, clocked by the CC camera. Factories rolling out weapons, wheeling out tanks, beneath the radar rook-infested storm, helicopters beat low over Stonehenge. Satellite heaven, black electronic cloud, cracked by media thunder. Shoppers galloping crazy down Oxford Street. Reality TV eyes staring flat across the flat, hard to the tore. The grid lines gather, the ley lines collect and hum, accumulating power. Tractors tattooed into the raw soil, etched into landscape skin. We huddle, we whisper against the terrorist and reaffirm our bond. We pray for petrol, diesel. The trucks muster and hurtle down the M4. Fluoro-jacketed police sharpshooters, deliver us.
Karen Stromberg, our next contributor, says merely that she has recently turned to writing flash fiction and the 10-minute play. But Karen's piece in this issue is closer in length to a conventional short story, and here it's read by Beth. Karen didn't really want to read it herself, but she was happy to let us have a crack at it.
The Last Man on Earth. She heard the plane long before it came into view, its small engine sputtering and whining. The jungle fell silent as the plane climbed into the sky and died. It hung weightless before spiraling into the ocean. A moment later, a parachute opened, one small blot in a pristine sky. She was impressed by the way the man worked the lines of his chute, swinging in his harness, moving toward land. Once he hit water, the white silk settled over him and floated on the surface like a large jellyfish. Well, that's that, she thought, watching the slow current carry the whole mess around the south end of the island. Later, just as the trio of black-crested gibbons were finishing their evening song, a yoo-hooing voice moved toward her. "Thank God for your signal fire," a young, haggard man sank to his knees. "It led me right to you." "Men," she thought, taking the single fish from the spit and offering it to him on a banana leaf. "Do you speak English?" he said a moment later, as he returned the leaf with its small nest of bones. "Yes, I do. English major. Virginia Woolf." Her eyes followed the scalloped moonlight of the shoreline. "I thought I'd done her one better." "Well, Virginia," the man said, laying out a large knife and a small folding saw, "your troubles are over. Tomorrow I'll start whipping this place into shape." At sunrise, he lashed the knife with its thick leather handle to a bamboo pole. "Any predators here, large ones?" he said, as he waded waist-deep into the lagoon. "Just us," she called. She watched as he brought up the first fish, a small grouper, a huge hole in its pink side, its gill covers flaring wildly. "There's no refrigeration," she said, watching the fish slam its tail against the sand. She stunned it with a stone. "Well done," he said, anointing her with a smile as he dropped a black bass beside the grouper. We can't eat all these. She inspected the wound on the bass. They won't keep. She raised her stone. I'm taking an inventory. It's good to know what you have. He grinned and trotted into the water, the spear glistening overhead. She dispatched the bass and walked to the next lagoon. As she bathed in the pristine water, small fish nibbled her fingers and toes. He was a nice-looking man, she thought. Good facial symmetry, adequate cranial circumference, and he had blue eyes. So did she. It tickled her to think that a recessive gene suddenly stood a small chance, not only of surviving, but of becoming dominant. We may be, he had said the night before, the last two people on Earth. A momentary gleam ignited in his exhausted eyes as he spread out the parachute like a silken sheet and fell asleep. Very likely we are, she'd murmured, as she curled her body against his and felt him pull her snug against his side. She had not told him about her surveyor's cabin with its small stove, cot, and 14 months' worth of ecological diaries. The line of dead and dying fish had tripled by the time she returned. The man stood thigh-deep in water, maneuvering a sea turtle toward land. That's an olive ridley, she said, recognizing its heart-shaped shell. They're critically endangered. Soup, he said, pinning the turtle to the beach with one foot. And there's monkeys here, too. He freed the knife from the pole. I've got something much better. She looked deep into his blue eyes. Much, much better. And just for you, she whispered, as he turned toward her and the turtle slid back into the water. She selected a pufferfish from the row of bodies on the beach, and taking the knife from his hand, she filleted it, liver and all.
Our next contributor was Carolee D. Sherwood, who says she frequently writes poems about body parts, but this was her first poem referencing military police. It's called After the Apocalypse, an English Tutor Considers Her Own Corpse.
After the Apocalypse, an English Tutor Considers Her Own Corpse. I live on a farm. We raise kidneys to meet the overwhelming demand for transplants after the explosion. Nearly everyone, it is believed, will need to replace one or both of their kidneys by age 54. When my grandparents were alive, corn filled the fields. But now, rows and rows of kidneys plump beneath the moon. They thrive in the night air. By day, they must drink from a constant spray of water. The stable looks like an ICU. Hospital beds nest in stalls where fat cows and their wobbly calves used to wait. Hundreds of people, livestock too, really, pass their days with dialysis here until the crop ripens. During the harvest, we'll feed dozens of doctors at the long table in the farmhouse. The military police eat under their tent near the guard shack. We barely notice them anymore, and our fear is mostly gone. My job is to teach English to field hands, who primarily speak Snorlax. Humans never developed a liking for tending organs. Interplanetary treaties permit laborers to work in specific industries. They travel years for jobs like these. My brother said they spy on us. I didn't believe it until he was arrested. I don't know where he is now, but I don't think he's alive. It is rumored that prisoner organs are cut away and dried for use as seed. We don't feel safe asking about the people we don't see anymore. No one ever dies of old age. They just disappear. I pull weeds at the old family plot near the forest and wonder what will become of my bones.
Continuing in a surrealist vein now, here's a piece from another first-time contributor, Jason Eric Lundberg. And from the rather lengthy bio of his that we published at the end of the issue, I'll just say that he's the co-publisher with his wife, artist-writer Janet Chewy, of Two Cranes Press, an independent publisher whose fourth book, A Field Guide to Surreal Botany, was just released. Jason's also a fan of the rock band Nine Inch Nails, so for background music here, he used a piece from their latest album, The Slip, which was made available in its entirety for use under a copyleft agreement. The name of the piece is Corona Radiata, and that's the background for Jason's piece, The Apocalypsis Pentaptic.
The Apocalypsis Pentaptic by Jason Eric Lundberg. 1. Lachrymose. She started crying at the age of 15 and could not stop. How it started, not even she knew now. Possibly getting dumped by that boy she liked, the one with the green eyes and the chestnut hair. Or it might have been that poetry contest she was sure she'd win, but didn't. Or it could have been just a burst of overwhelming hormones. Whatever the cause, she cried and cried, and then when she was ready to stop, she found herself unable. Her tear ducts locked open, the flow of saline a constant thing. The bucket that her mother placed by her bed was replaced by a larger bucket to decrease the trips to the bathroom to empty it. With no sign of stopping, her father bought an inexpensive bathtub and rigged up the plumbing so that the tears would funnel to the outside and connect up with the drainpipe. But the tears continued unabated, and soon the garden was flooded, and then the entire yard. The doctors were stumped, and angry at their shoes being ruined by all the salt water. She wasn't getting dehydrated, they said, so we don't have any idea where the water is coming from. She was taken to the Grand Canyon, but she filled it. They placed her in the sewers, but she flooded them. Her parents drove her out to the middle of Arizona and left her there. Her tears overflowed the world, drowned out the buildings, the people. She floated on an oak door in a sea of her sadness and cried for her solitude. But soon, survivors appeared on their makeshift rafts and said, "We are here to worship you, to tell you that you are not alone." She looked at the small band of travelers who had sacrificed so much to reach her, and she smiled. The tears slowed, then stopped. She was happy. 2. Detritus. You knew this would happen, didn't you? I don't put it past you to have omitted certain facets of my existence, to leave me out of the loop. Oh, I just didn't get around to telling you, you might have said, or, well, I really didn't think it was that important. But it is important. My dissolution is pretty fucking important. When you patched me together from the corpses of others, you knew I would have a shelf life, a termination point, a sell-by date. A decade of life may seem like a long time, but it's just a drop in the bucket, a cosmic blink. I'm disposable, the tissue you casually toss into the bin when it no longer serves your purpose. I've tried to hide it with baggy clothes, but people are starting to notice the pieces dropping off of me, like a snake's second skin. Only this is my only skin, these my only parts, and I am slowly losing them all. It has been 5 years since I escaped from your laboratory, and the people of this lost European city have grown used to seeing me on the streets. But the smell is getting unbearable, this leprosy of the undead, and even when I try to buy bread or fish at the market stalls, the merchants see the trail, the long trail of detritus extending behind me, the rotted bits and pieces of me, and they deny me purchase, cowering behind their stalls, as if they could catch my affliction. It's hard to walk now that my toes are all gone. I sneezed last week, and my nose dropped into my lap. When I set out a saucer of cream yesterday for the neighborhood cats, my lower lip and one of my ears slid off my face and splashed into the whiteness. It can't be much longer now. What will be left of me when this is all done? How will I be found? An assemblage of body parts now come unstitched? It seems such a senseless way to end this existence. I wonder what the gendarmes will think when they investigate my dissolution. Times like these, I wish I hadn't escaped. Maybe you could have fixed me, replaced the old bits with new. Maybe if you hadn't died of emphysema, I always scolded you for your cigars. I could have pleaded with you for a longer life. Maybe you would have agreed, but it no longer matters. So I sit in my dusty hovel, and I read the broadsheets, holding the papers with my few remaining fingers. Every time I cough, bits of my lungs separate themselves from the rest of me. I sit here and read, and slowly fall to pieces. 3. Incarnadine. The more he scrubs it, the more it bleeds. It is the size of a tick, and clutches fast to an area just below the pit of his right knee, at the top of his calf. But he is not worried about Lyme disease, since it is, in fact, not a tick. When they take you up into the blinding light, you are disoriented and afraid. When they return you, often without any memory of the abduction, they leave behind a tracking device, an organic nub that relays information about location and blood sugar level and thyroid balance. Most don't remember the trip, the examinations, the scrutiny, the taking apart and putting back together again. Most don't, but he does. It has been 3 months, and he wakes every night, screaming and tangled in sheets soaked through with his own sweat. When he tried pulling off the tracking device, every joint in his body shrieked with the feeling of shards of glass being ground in. When he tried to burn it off with an acetylene torch, his heart and lungs temporarily shut down. When he tried to drown it in rubbing alcohol, he urinated blood for a week. He feels them peering into his brain, using the device to look through his eyes, feel through his skin. More and more, his body does not feel like his own. And so he scrubs at the tracking device that looks like a tick but isn't, grinding the steel wool into its surface and the surrounding skin of his calf, turning both a deep incarnadine. He is still scrubbing as they reappear, blinding him with blue-white light, gently taking the steel wool from his raw fingers, looking this time more angry than inquisitive, numbing his nerves with their long fingers, no longer interested in examination. As he quickly falls into the black hole of unconsciousness, he knows that he will not be returning this time, that this time they are abducting him to inflict punishment, to teach him who is dominant, that resistance is useless. 4. Hypomnesia. We sit here, you and I, together in this cell, unknowing, unaware. I watch your jerky movements, spastic, the twitches of thousands of misfired neurons. I do not remember you, and from your blank look I can see that the feeling is mutual. I do know that I loved you, even if your identity is gone, like mine. The dry cake they feed us, delivered once a day through a wall tube, crumbles like ash, tasteless, void of nutritional value. Water drips somewhere, but I cannot locate its source. I am thirsty, my lips cracked, my skin parchment. I know nothing other than this cell and you. Why do they, whoever they are, keep us here? Flashes of intelligence secrets linger in my hippocampus, though nothing I can grab onto, vaporous and ephemeral in the eye of my mind. Information important to the opposition, to the rebels. Haven't we given them everything they want to know? Whatever procedure they used to delete my memories seems to have overloaded your poor brain, and you can only communicate now in grunts, reversed down the evolutionary chain to your simian ancestors. Your movements become more erratic every day, and I fear you will turn violent. Perhaps they have forgotten about us, now that they know everything we know. Maybe our side attacked, and is unaware we are here. Or you were actually the interrogator, and I fought back. Or maybe the reverse is true. It's impossible to know for sure. The air grows thin. I have lost all hope of being released from this place. Either I will starve, or you will kill me in ignorant rage. I do hope it happens quickly. The one thing I hang on to is the knowledge, perhaps false, perhaps true, that at one time, long ago, I held you in my arms and kissed you, and you kissed me back. 5. Mellifluous. She stood there mesmerized as Honey Volcano erupted in front of her, awake now after 2 millennia of dormancy. Sugar crystals ignited in the air, then drifted down to settle on the thatched roofs of the homes of the townspeople. Screams from behind her and the thunder of stampeding exodus, but she couldn't take her eyes away from the exploding mountain. Thick, syrupy lava oozed a swath down the slope, its path taking it straight into town, straight through her. She closed her eyes and let it claim her. She recited the poetry of her ancestors as it flowed over her feet, ankles, shins, knees, waist, stomach, breasts, shoulders. Her words still uttered as the honey-colored lava slipped over her head, her words as mellifluous as the flow, her voice preserved for centuries. Today, if you can find the poor abandoned village, and if you can manage to excavate down to the houses and trees and lives that were assimilated by Honey Volcano, and if you chip away at the lava rock enough to find an air bubble, in that moment of release, when your pick frees the air that has been trapped for hundreds of years, you will hear ancient poetry, recited by a faint but beautiful female voice. Background music is the song Corona Radiata by Nine Inch Nails. This is from the album The Slip, which is available at nin.com. and is also licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-alike license.
Next we turn to Alex Seagal. He was born in the Ukraine and has lived in New York City since 1975. His poems have recently appeared in Colorado Review, Green Mountains Review, Hanging Loose, Many Mountains Moving, and McSweeney's, forthcoming in a number of other places, and he's also published a number of translations of Russian poetry.
Ravenous ermine in front of velvet ropes. Past Cerberus-headed security men, VIP admission seduction guaranteed, among stuffed couches and cavernous lounges, a studied glimpse at a closed circle of hell where man eats man till there is nothing left. Cold-blooded lizards repose in the limelight, surrounded by mysterious pieces of detritus, a patchwork of brick and textured plaster, the bodies gouged and the skin punctured. strutting for the paparazzi, then slinking, scurrying away, here an African fetish, there the head of a doge in alabaster. Flaking formica tabletops displayed as splattered paintings, their wild beauty of outright decay and its cousin accident. Time's ability to turn anything into art, whether man-made or genuine and natural, the posed, the candid, stillborn and mundane. The great confusion of life imitating life, a skull covered jewel-like with scarabs that holds a dead rat in its gaping mouth. But grimmest of all were the star's handlers, there being no such thing as bad publicity and a line between fame and misfortune. What I like best is it got us fucked up. We partied so hard we woke up the dead. It was the final blackout of the year.
Next, we'll hear from Ray Templeton, a Scottish writer and musician whose poems, short fiction, and reviews have been published widely around the web as well as in print.
At the Last Hotel. In here, where they stop along the way, the night porters taking care of business, arrivals and departures, room service, security and welfare. He holds the keys, manages the risks, a visible deterrent. He checks the entryways, dark corners of reception, the unattended spaces. He's the one who picks up what the travellers leave behind, collects abandoned suitcases and bags. He observes, arranges meetings, monitors trespasses and transgressions, writes reports. Left alone, he'll clear the till and count the day's receipts, and then, one elbow on the desk, a little quiet music, he reads The Guardian or The Evening Argus. Midnight amplifies the tick of the revolving door, footsteps in the lobby, sudden buzz of the night bell.
Now for another poem by Sarah J. Sloat. This is a short piece called Tin.
Tin. On TV, we saw a woman living with her kids in a tin slum. She showed the cameraman an open stove, a hairbrush on a box that was her bedside table. Along one wall, dirty water trickled around bullet holes, ticking, rimmed by the reporter's voiceover. How we like to focus on what's close up. We don't even know where the bullets go. Through cities and forests, clean into the open air.